And then you can recognize the chief.
Sure. I hereby call the meeting to order and note those who have been mentioned as in attendance and offer the mic to the chief that he may share with us as he feels appropriate.
And just for the record, the people present are Carl McCluster, Chris LaRoque, and Nello Malerba from the Charter Revision Commission, as well as Chief Narowski and Corporation Counsel Vincent Marino. Also present here is the president of the Alderman Charles Sampson from the Third Ward. Make sense?
Yep, that's good.
Okay, Chief.
Okay, where should we begin? How about we'll go question by question? Is that what you want to do, or?
Can I just procedural question, sure. Mark? We talked at the general committee about there being two parts to the to the law enforcement package, if you will. One being the unionized and one being the non-unionized employees. And so it was my understanding that the primary function of this particular conversation was to deal with the non-unionized employees, primarily the chief and the two staff people given by different names, whether they be, they're in two different places, they're named two different things, lieutenants in another place as detective sergeants. So to clarify that, and just to say, are we here to talk about that piece, which is the non-unionized piece, or are we here also to discuss the unionized piece of it?
If you're asking me, my review of the minutes was that you wanted to talk about the non-union positions.
Right.
Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, that was what I thought we would do. I thought the unionized part was going to be back to the general committee, unless someone else was assigned as a single person to review and come back to us.
That's my recollection in reviewing the minutes.
Okay. Thanks. There you go, Chief.
Okay. So just to clarify, give you a little bit of the background here. Around 2005-ish, the current charter refers to the chief of police and the lieutenant. A lieutenant is a middle manager position in law enforcement. What ended up happening were the second in command of the organization was being ostracized by the law enforcement community because we didn't meet the minimum standards to attend things. For example, my third in command attended the National Academy, FBI Academy in Quantico. They would not accept a rank lower than lieutenant. Lieutenant was only there on a conditional period, and that person held the rank of detective sergeant. So we have titles and we have ranks. We couldn't change the charter because that's done at your level. So what we had to do is we had to fix titles in the organization. So I can show you a couple of things that are important. I'm going to share a screen real quick. I'm going to pull up a PowerPoint if I can. All right, hopefully I can show you this. Make it larger. Okay, so what you're looking at is an organizational chart. So where people sit are not necessarily, which shift they're assigned to is not necessarily current, but the staffing is current. So you have me at the top, which is the chief of police. That's clearly indicated in the charter and in collective bargaining and everywhere. The deputy chief is a title that's referred to within the organization, within the collective bargaining agreement, and it refers to the chartered position of lieutenant, which has never been changed. When we move down here, I have two middle managers. They are called by the rank of lieutenant here and lieutenant here within the organization and in the law enforcement community, but by charter, they hold the rank of detective sergeant, which is really something that's not common in most organizations. What I also did here, because I know there's gonna be a question coming up on minimum standards for either hire or promotion to chief, So what I want you to do is just take a little look here at this. And I know we were talking about a bachelor's degree for a deputy chief. I can go through that, you know, bullet by bullet. For chief of police by charter. I can go through that by bullet, but realistically, the industry standard is much higher than that. It's going to be a master's, double master's, or PhD, at least a master's level. So what I've indicated here is all of these darker gold are people that hold master's degrees. So I have 4 degrees. I have 2 master's degrees related to law enforcement. Deputy chief holds a master's degree. Our operations commander is actually an attorney. He holds a JD. We have a few more master's degrees throughout the organization. The other people that are here that are in the lighter orange all hold bachelor's degrees in some type of a field. So I haven't hired a police officer that hasn't had a degree in 15 year plus years. The officers here that are in the yellow have some form of college credits, whether it be a few dozen or literally a class or two away from graduating with a bachelor's degree. So you see that majority of the organization has some type of a college degree. Now, what I will show you, let me back out of this. I'm going to show you a different PowerPoint presentation very quickly. And you just got to bear with me 1 second. Okay. So can everybody see that on their screen? Okay, so that is part of our collective bargaining unit agreement. So what happens is that the charter and the collective bargaining agreement are intertwined. The majority of the stuff in the chart that's in the charter is actually covered in the collective bargaining agreement. So what ends up happening in this collective bargaining agreement is the rank of the deputy chief is throughout the agreement responds to the corresponding charter position of lieutenant, and the rank of lieutenant corresponds to detective sergeant. So that's clarified in here for how we do business. So if we mess with the titles, it has tentacles that spread out into other agreements, into our operations and procedures manual, into collective bargaining, et cetera. So our recognition clause talks about these titles. How we fill positions with the lieutenant or deputy chief is done via the collective bargaining agreement. So controlling the chief of police position is done by charter. Controlling of the deputy chief position or the appointment of that person is controlled by collective bargaining. So you're moving from a union position to a non-union. So the only 2 non-union members required by law is the officer in charge of the organization and the 2IC, the second in charge. They have to be out of a collective bargaining agreement. So when we talk about this, the promotional exams, I just want that to be very clear on how this occurs. It's a very rigorous procedure. So what happens is you have a very comprehensive test. It's from within the entire organization. And I actually pulled out my books from my last promotional exam. This is it. Thousands of pages of reading. It's about 3, 4, 5 months of preparation for this to take a very comprehensive written exam. You have to pass with a minimum of 70% in that written exam. The exam is done by professionals. It's not written by us. It has nothing to do with our organization. It's administered by South Central Criminal Justice Administration. They monitor the entire region. It's basically proctored by a PhD who does this for a living. The second part of this is a oral examination. That oral examination is either situational, general knowledge, specific police knowledge questions from peers. They're generally chiefs of police, at a minimum, a deputy chief of police from organizations that are distant from us. They're not contiguous. Nobody knows anybody. We may have people come in from, you know, Torrington to sit on a panel with us. It's very objective and not subjective at all. The numbers are normed. Again, a PhD proctors this, and it's been a very valid testing process, and it happens over the course of, you know, a great period of time. Recently, they just added that there's service points added for years of service into this entire promotional process. The other thing is we changed the written in the oral board in this last collective bargaining agreement because we wanted to make sure that this was equitable. What we're trying to do is we're trying to encourage more minorities to apply. We've added service points for speaking Spanish and fluency and also prior military service. But what we wanted to do is make sure that once we start getting more and more minorities into the organization, that we level the playing field. So we changed the weights based on some information that was provided to us from these resources. We lowered the percentage on the written, and we raised the percentage on the oral board because it's very important to be able to think quick on your feet, have command presence, and be street smart in addition to be book smart. So that's a little of this stuff. Something else I threw in having to do with the collective bargaining agreement is how we hire police officers. I saw some comments very quickly in there about talking about a minimum of a bachelor's degree or to be hired as a patrolman. I don't necessarily think that's a good idea because with the limited pool of candidates that we have right now, it may actually have the opposite effect or unintended consequences of actually excluding some minorities and not leveling the playing field. The other thing that ends up happening is, you know, there was a comment in there somewhere about having to take a polygraph. Well, that's the law. So if you look at this, what happens is we have POST, Police Officer Standards Training Council. They're our certifying agency. We have to come in and meet all their qualifications. Then they also have to pass physical agility. The entry examinations, they also take a written and a oral board, a background, which is very extensive, polygraph, psychological, medical, drug test, et cetera. There's credit checks, there's a bunch of other stuff that comes into here. Lastly, we talked about the ability to do lateral transfers. I don't know if you need to address it in the charter because it's in the collective bargaining agreement. Basically, nothing here limits the city to hiring currently certified officers, lateral transfers, and this allows us to go in and pay them commensurate with their pay grade. So if they come into the organization with 4 years experience, we can start them at what a fourth year patrolman starts in Derby. The only thing that's kind of missing out of here is vacation time. So if I get somebody that wants to leave Waterbury and they want to come to Derby because it's too crazy working there, they'll come, and if they have 10 years on the job, the top pay grade patrolman is pay grade 5, but they're not going to get the vacation time that they may be losing there. So that may be a little bit of a deterrent. So I'm going to just drop this and stop sharing and just talk a little bit about this stuff. So where we've come from as an organization is basically you had to be a part-time employee, a supernumerary police officer. Candidate pool was very small, shallow. It was Derby residents only. And as a Derby resident, you had to be willing to take a part-time job. And once you proved yourself in that part-time position, then you were eligible to apply to the full-time position. It's crazy the way it actually worked because you had to think of, I got on when I was 19. I just turned 19. It's now 21 years old. You have to find a 21-year-old kid who doesn't want a full-time job, who wants to work part-time, and then wait and do your time till there's a full-time opening and then try to take that job. It was not a very successful process. We ended up training a lot of part-time police officers for the entire state. I think out of the last group of 20, we lost 19 of them. We were basically training everybody, all the police departments, recruits for them. So now we have the ability to do this lateral transfer. At that time, you know, we came from a organization in the 70s and the early 80s of, hey, my cousin wants to apply, okay, we'll do that, to now it's a very rigorous statewide process. We hire from policeapp.com, which pings out all over the internet. And then I said, we use a independent agency. We don't actually see who applied to our agency until we get a list from that testing agency, which we have nothing to do with. Same thing happens with the promotional exams. So getting to where we are with this, we have always had a pool of people that could have taken this position. I think the last time they promoted a patrolman to chief was Van Etten in 1928. At that point in time, you had no sergeants. Basically, the staffing was patrolman, lieutenant, chief. That was it. There was three ranks. And so you really couldn't promote anyone but the lieutenant. So now what ends up happening is you need to have a minimum requirement to become chief. You need an associate's degree, and you need to have 5-year supervisory experience. So that automatically excludes every patrolman because they don't have supervisory experience. The nice thing that ends up happening when you promote from within is you've vetted the people. You know what you're getting. The average tenure of a police chief nationwide is 3 years. I've been here 10. I've been here 32 total. You know what you got. And the problem is, when you have appointed chiefs, is quite often they can become a political puppet. So one of the things with the charter protection is I've told many administrations that I can't do that. And while they may have had good intentions of doing something, that's the kind of stuff people go to jail for. You can have, you know, we have stuff going across the river there in Shelton. Now, not speaking towards the individual, but speaking towards the background, he was basically a trooper at the lowest level. Detective is not a promotion in the state police, and with zero supervisory experience, stepped into the position. And here we are with all the stuff you see in the news today. So that's one of the things by having somebody tested through the organization. The deputy chief tests for the position from the union, and they sit in that seat. As long as they sit in that seat for a year, and they have the 5-year supervisory experience, which they're pretty much going to have because they're either going to have earned it in this position or at the sergeant level or at the lieutenant level, then they should be promoted up. And actually, when you take that position, you know, Vin can comment on this, but I believe you have a property right in that job. You take the job with a certain set of circumstances. Now, the question is, what happens when we don't have a qualified deputy chief to move into the position? I think it's highly unlikely in this environment with these industry standards, but if that were to occur, I have no qualms about going to the outside. I don't think you should try to force a square peg into a round hole and promote a detective or a patrolman into that position. Last thing we want is somebody unqualified in this position. So that's kind of some of the background. I don't know if you want to go step by step with the questions that were, or the proposals in the charter revision, or any questions for me, or I don't know how you want to proceed.
What is your pleasure, Joan?
Mr. McCluster, Charlie Sampson, and if I could, I just would like to take 5 minutes of committee's time.
The clock is ticking.
Thank you, sir. I had originally asked the committee to review the qualification for the position of police chief and advance it to a minimum of a bachelor's degree from an associate's degree as the charter states. I highly agree with Chief Narowski that even a bachelor's degree in today's day and age is not common for chiefs of police, that they should be obtaining better. I also asked you to limit the succession to chief to those who attained a minimum number of years as a supervisory role, as well as the required schooling. I did also hear comments about the chief's position going to an outside candidate looking for our best option. And although I didn't speak about it that evening, I'll just give you my thoughts tonight. And my thoughts come after 30 plus years experience in policing. I worked in a large city, now in a smaller town, and have encompassed 8 different chiefs in my time. Now, Derby, although incorporated as a city, is a small town of some 12,000 citizens, approximately 35 to 40 officers. As the charter states today, the now deputy chief falls in succession when the chief retires. I would submit to this committee that this succession is actually a better choice than searching for a chief nationwide based upon our stature and the size of policing. The deputy chief typically has numerous years in the supervisory role, as the chief has stated, within the department, spanning over several years before being promoted to that position of deputy chief. They're familiar with the community and its needs, the needs of the department as it tries to move forward, and the well-being of the officers who serve in this community. More importantly, the deputy chief has made a life investment in this community. One doesn't have to look far, as the chief mentioned, to see how devastating an outside individual filling such an important role has on a department, which in some ways unfortunately reflects on the service to the community. Without the relationship built over numerous years of service within the department and the community, the ramifications can be devastating, and the community will ultimately suffer the lack of intimate policing services and the lack of forethought as the department moves forward. That's my take on the promotion of the deputy into the chief's position. A couple other things that the chief did talk about, and I know you don't want to get into the contractual of the unionized personnel, but the charter does talk about the hiring. I asked that the supernumerary pool be removed from the charter. Because that is now covered in the collective bargaining agreement, I say that this committee just either recommend the removal of that language as a whole, or that that language be incorporated, that the hiring of regular police officers is based upon contractual language as set forth in the collective bargaining agreement.
Sorry, Mr. Seth, could you say that last statement again? I just want to make sure I heard it clearly.
Yeah, just going back, the hiring of new police officers, I had asked that you remove the supernumerary pool part of that, the charter, and update it. So I believe that this committee could recommend that you either just remove the language on the hiring and simply state that hiring of regular officers will be based upon the contractual language as set forth in the contractual bargaining agreement. This also includes, I had put something in there about lateral transfers. That's also included in the CBA. And I believe after approving that CBA that it covers that 110%, as the chief has explained tonight and the contractual language explains. My last thought is just, as the chief brought up the staffing structure of the department, I don't think this board has to get mired down with the staffing structure. I would ask that maybe some language be put into the charter in regards to the staffing structure, which was changed several years ago and approved by the sitting boards at that time. I believe that the chief of police needs room to restructure the department as they see fit and times change. So without having to beat this one to death every 5 or 10 years, that the wording states that somewhere along the lines, and Attorney Marino is better at this than I am, that the organizational structure of the police department should adhere to the department's policy and procedures manual, where typically the staffing structure or organizational structure is defined, and any changes to that must be approved by the appropriate boards. What I mean by appropriate boards is, today, if the chief wanted to come before the boards and ask for an increase in even one more officer, it has to be approved by the Board of Aldermen and Alderwomen, and also has to be approved, the funding has to be approved by the vote. So there is a procedure in place for that. And that's pretty much my take on things, and I'm going to sit here and listen in case anybody has any questions of my comments.
Any specific question? Thank you, Charles. Any specific questions? And within 5 minutes, by the way. Very well
said. I tried
said.
Hard.
anyone have specific questions for what Charlie has brought to us? So none coming. I have a couple of simple thoughts, not necessarily questions, because when you refer to the idea of the intimacy that comes from, and it's of course professional intimacy you're talking about, that comes from having people within engaged, and having people from the outside, reverts to a lack of, you know, I think you use the term lack of intimacy. But with that lack of intimacy comes an increase of transparency. Intimacy is where it's in the dark places, in the familiar places, that we often see challenges that come up with objective and transparent policing, the application thereof. How do you apply a law, or how do you make a decision about a subjective call as it relates to things that happen? And I think that with many eyes, the more transparency there is, the clearer, the better potential for a quality outcome. And then the example of Shelton being a bad event does not put into play at all the thousands of other cases around the country where we had good or bad events from that type of transfer in. So I don't want to get stuck because it happened in Shelton, it's going to happen in Derby. I think that that's something that we have to, if we're going to cite that as an example, then we need to look broader so that we have a statistically significant small n sampling to be able to know that that's something that occurs or that creates a certain effect, as opposed to, after all, we are Derby, not Shelton, I heard the kids say at a game recently or last year. and having lived in both Shelton and Derby, I think there's a different culture in the police departments in both of those two cities, towns. Having had a chance to talk to folk in both places. I am curious about the idea that was brought forward by the chief about property rights. Vin, do you want to, Vincent, do you want to sort of weigh in on that a little bit and give us your feeling about this idea of property rights? It would have been my assumption that, well, let me hear from you first before I give an assumption.
He jumped off.
Okay. It says total non-video participants.
There you go.
Five.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Oh, excellent. So in the public sector, most positions, but specifically the police chief and the deputy chief positions create constitutionally protected property rights in those positions. It's very difficult, and that's why it is very difficult to remove a chief or a deputy chief. There's actually statutes that have to be followed, and it's a very difficult process to remove them if there was a desire to remove them. So the real major distinction between the public sector and the private sector is that in the public sector, this concept has evolved over, I guess, the century, that positions carry with them protected property rights. And so to the extent the deputy chief now is part of a contract or a process where there's a succession plan that is, generally speaking, a condition of his employment, to change that could create a couple of issues. One is If it's part of the CBA, it could be a prohibited practice. Number two is it's infringing upon his rights, his property interests in the position. So it could put a claim adverse to the city in favor of those who have that interest. So you have to be very careful. It's not as easy as it sounds when you have a system like this. Not every community has a system like this, but it's not easy to change.
So is that a formal, you know, legal opinion then that property rights will survive in this scenario?
Absolutely. Okay. It doesn't mean you can't change it, but you very well may be creating a cause of action in favor of any positions that have that interest.
So that would go to say that it could never change then without, or that if there is a change, there certainly could be a challenge.
There certainly could be a challenge. Again, no guarantee that the individual would be successful. But obviously you do have the right to change it, but with the change runs the consequence of liability.
So is there a case law on that you're looking at, Ben?
I'm not looking at it now. It's from my experience, but there are plenty of cases that stand for that proposition about the property interest in these positions.
Okay. So I think what would be helpful to me as a committee member would be to, if not to tonight here, sharing me all the case law, but the basis for your the legal basis for your thought. And then when you talk about statutes, are we talking about state statutes or local statutes?
Yeah, so there are Connecticut general statutes that relate to the removal of the chief of police. Mm-hmm. And I can provide you with a copy of that as well.
So when we talked about that in at the last meeting, we talked about what the statutes were and the difference between the statute ruling and home rule. So you want to revisit that real quickly for me?
Yeah, so in certain instances, there's a concept, again, that has evolved that says if the statute is in conflict with a local rule, so a charter or a local ordinance, and where the legislature has not said, notwithstanding, there are specific statutes that say notwithstanding a charter or a local ordinance or special act, this is what you have to do. Where a statute is in conflict with a local rule, there's a concept of home rule, meaning that the people at the local level have the right to make decisions on certain subjects that may be different just, for example, between Shelton and Derby. So it's unless the legislature has reserved that to itself. And again, when it has, it will say in the statute, notwithstanding, any local ordinance, charter, provision, or special act. When it comes to the police chief's removal statute, that is a matter of state precedence. And so you would be obliged to follow that process. For example, if we wanted to remove the current chief from office, there's a whole statutory process we'd have to follow.
This would not be
subject to home rule.
Any other questions before I dive down my list here? I don't want to dominate the conversation. Chris, do you have anything?
Sorry. No, I mean, when I was reviewing the CBA and the charter and all the stuff in with regards to this meeting and thinking about, like, hey, what do we really want to see changed? And then what do we really feel like the problems are? Or not necessarily the problems. Let me put it in a slightly different way. You know, what we could do and what we thought, things that we could address more. I mean, I went there and I just looked and saw that, when you look at who the makeup of the police commission, and if that's a way we can help to, bring more outside voices in, and, in terms of accountability and, the appearance of insularity, I think those are the things that I thought about, and I thought, like, hey, if this doesn't work out and for some reason that we can't do that, we could, the charter could be enlarged to include more folks, perhaps, on the commissioner, the more police commissioners. But that was just my thought. But I do want to continue to go through what you had to say about the more technical side of this. So.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. So.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I do got a quick question, if possible. So if I'm understanding this correctly, and I think Attorney Marino can answer this for me. If we do change, say we, for whatever reason, if we are going to change something, and I think you kind of touched on this, but I'll make sure I'm hearing it right. In order for basically the city not to get sued, we almost would have to grandfather in what we currently have and basically going forward. Or because if we don't, for example, if you want to change the process of hiring the deputy chief to chief, the current deputy chief, because he meets the requirements, might have a claim against the city, if I'm understanding all this correctly. Okay. All right. Thank you.
So I'm sorry, Vince. You're muted. Oh. Vince is muted. Can you guys hear Vince?
No, I can't hear
him. Can you hear me?
No,
can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Right. So to the extent that, you want to grandfather it in, that's only one part of the conversation. And the chief can answer, if this is part of a CBA, then you have to negotiate with the union to change that. And, the union would be asking for some major concessions, I suspect, to give something like that up, because it protects their union members, is my kind of initial take on it. But, Chief, I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Of course, when people take promotions in the organization, they're looking at the end state here. And I'm going to be honest with you, I'm not going anywhere. So before any of this even takes effect, you got 14 years. So unless there's a plan to remove me, I'm planning on staying here. Again, the next two people in line far exceed the qualifications, even if you set it at bachelor's or master's. They have dozens of years of supervisory experience. But the other thing that I'm looking at the charter, and not many people actually have books like this, but I have a few of them. I have like three different versions of them, so I can see how this progressed. But I'm reading the most current version. It refers to these titles in different places, and there's a whole bunch of ordinances that you're not in control over, but that refer to all these things too. So the danger here is if we change, and I'm not saying suggesting, but if we change a title in any of this, it impacts all the ordinances, collective bargaining agreement, a whole bunch of stuff. And I've got to be honest, to push this through, I'm looking for the devil in the details here, because if you push this through with good intentions and there's tentacles, it may have unintended consequences. So to be honest with you, I would love to sit down and look at things here. If you look at the ordinances, it says you shall be 5'7" or taller to be a police officer. You must be a male. I mean, that's illegal. There must be, according to your charter here, there must be one female police officer. That's illegal. You can't do that. You can't mandate a minimum, a person like that. I mean, so there's stuff in here that's really antiquated. I mean, you have ordinances that talk about offal, basically animal scrapings on the side of the road that need to be removed from a lot of this stuff. It's a dirty charter, but I mean, in these two or three pages, I can go through. I mean, this might be a better thing to sit down and go fix the whole thing in here. But I am not in favor of changing the, I don't have any say, I'm just voicing my opinion of this vacancy of the chief of police and going outside. Note that not many departments do that. Woodbridge, Orange, Seymour, Ansonia, they all hire and promote from within. So it is not the norm. It's a norm in bigger cities, and it's dangerous politically. So I will tell you that, because I've seen that happen in other agencies. So that's my two cents. Did I answer your question, Ben? I'm sorry. Okay.
So one of my questions is, given what the chief has just said, how do we develop title congruency within Derby? It's ridiculous to allow this to just continue to be the malaise and the shadow that's cast upon any decision that's made. And I would look to ask the question, how do we achieve title congruency across our charter, our statutes, and everything else that we're working on here? How does that best happen? Is there a clear pathway for that to occur? And that it sounds like some part of it might be a charter revision, but the rest of it is actually just a coming into line with the charter. So you can either, because the charter is a single document that is constructed a certain way, it would seem easier that you could take the other documents, since you're referring to the same positions, and bring them in line with the charter. Would that be the process, Ben?
Well, again, number one is I agree with the chief. The charter, I think, probably has just been bastardized over the decades. There is way too much in the charter. When I did my initial, like, if I were redrafting the charter and I went through it, I deleted half of it, if not three quarters of it. The charter should be the basic organizational document of the community that gives the foundation to grow from, and then you should regulate through ordinance rather than through, should not regulate through the charter, because the charter should be with the community for decades, and ordinances and laws change more frequently than that. So, but number one, just going to what the chief says, if there's something in the charter, because the charter is subject to voter approval, and voters are curious subjects to discuss, why they act a certain way and why they don't is a mystery. There is, kind of jokingly, in Orange, we had a charter revision, and like 300 people voted against the request to just clean up the charter grammatically. Who would be opposed to that? But, 300 people were opposed to that. So in this instance, if there's something that is illegal in your charter, the court, the law would say you can't do it. So you disregard the illegality in the charter. Only that which is legal can be followed. So in the event you were to suggest here, for example, to use the chief's example, that there must be one woman. Well, that's an illegal proposition. So if the voters rejected deleting that from the charter, it really doesn't matter. You can't do that.
Counselor, but that's an ordinance. He's referring to an ordinance.
I understand that. I'm using that as an example, Mark. I'm not using it as a specificity. So the point being is we can go through this charter and we can take out what we find offensive, what we find illegal. It's always subject to the voter approval. And regardless of what the voters say, if something is illegal, it's not enforceable. So getting to your question, it's not as easy as it sounds to reconcile everything, because the processes are different. The ordinances have to go through public hearing process and are dealt with at the Board of Aldermen level. That's actually easier than the charter revision, because the charter revision gets voted on at either a municipal election, a federal election, or a special election. Again, it's subject to voter approval. Do the voters understand what you're suggesting? Are they pissed off about another topic, so they're going to vote against everything? You just don't know when you're subject to the vote of the constituents. So it's hard to answer your question on what the path is forward, other than to say, I think it's best to focus on things that you believe you can get through. And the way that you get through things like this is to chip away at it. You do it over time. If you do it all at once, you're going to overwhelm the voters. They're not going to understand it, and you're going to probably lose everything. So my suggestion would be you chip away at it. You find one or two things that you find generally consensus over. And because if a charter revision is divided, If it's a charter revision commission is divided on a subject, you're probably more likely than not going to get approval from the voters. So, you know, my suggestion here is, you know, with the assistance of the chief, if there are things that can be addressed that are not overwhelmingly significant things, you might want to start there. If there's nothing that can be addressed at this time, then what I would say is you table this subject to after the November election, because if I recall from a prior meeting, this commission is going to remain in effect post November election, and you're going to continue your work into the municipal election. So I think that's probably your best way, you know, because our best wish, where we can just fix it ourselves, is nothing we can do.
So the short of it, what you're saying, Vin, is that, sorry, I was glancing at police stop records for Connecticut for another reason. But my question was, is in terms of developing title congruency, you know, you say that it's near impossible to bring all the other pieces in line with the charter and use the same nomenclature?
It's challenging because it depends on what needs to get changed, and because of the processes that they have to go through. If it deals with changing the charter, you're subject to voter approval, and we don't know what the outcome of that's going to be. If it's changing the ordinances, then you're subject to Board of Aldermen approval. That's going to be an easier process, but it's still a process, and you don't know what the Board of Aldermen are going to do on any given night. So, you know, again, it's, we cannot, as a commission, make any changes. We can only make recommendations. And all our jurisdiction is to discuss the charter, not to discuss the ordinances. As a citizen, you have every right to say whatever you want to the Board of Aldermen about ordinances, and, you know, but that's not within the jurisdiction of the Charter Commission.
So, you know, I won't take offense on Charlie's behalf for that, not knowing what the aldermen are going to do any given night there, Ben, okay?
He would agree with me, I think.
But the idea that, you know, we did get some suggestions from the city council, from the aldermen, about what needs to be done in the charter. And I would ask that we immediately commend some parts of this back to the city council so that they can get this low-hanging fruit. You know, many things that Jerry just brought out were things that are obvious if one reads through it, right? So I don't know who the clerk, the assistant, the whoever that needs to read through that so that we can be congruent about getting rid of some of the simple stuff, because I don't think that the voter's going to go crazy because we take out the, you know, there must be a single woman or whatever, or that the person must be 5'7" and those sorts of things. That's easy cleanup stuff, and it's just clouding key issues that we're dealing with. So I don't know if, is that something that we're taking on, or, you know, unless Charlie's going to say the city council's, you know, confident in doing that, you know, I think that this isn't a 1 month job. It's probably a 6 hour job with a grease pencil on that thing. Charlie's right. Not answering me. So I don't know if he's not volunteering the city council to jump in there and take care of this.
Well, Mr. McCluster, I'll be honest with you. I think your board is actually hitting the nail on the head with a number of issues that we all face in the political world. And it goes back to, I think, what Attorney Marino said, where, you know, this board can suggest making the charter that founding document and that ordinances move forward. I trust me, this is, The fact that I'll give you a little story off the record. I was, I know it's recorded,
last time I was thinking I was off the record, you know.
Yeah.
I heard nepotism in the paper the next day.
I can see recording in the top corner, but I took the test to be a Derby police officer 30 years ago. And policing has changed, and thank goodness Chief Narowski and you know, former chiefs have changed it to accommodate the laws of today and the rules. So I am committed, as long as I'm a member of the Board of Alders, to, you know, make things right. I think the intimacy that you brought up, I see from a different perspective, where I think it makes it easier for, you know, the average citizen to go to the chief of police and say, you know, what happened here? And because of the relationships of the community, that the chief of police is comfortable in talking about things, making it more transparent than it obviously is today in some larger cities and towns. I don't think Derby, on the most part, falls under those type of issues. But once again, as a member of the Board of Alders, I'm here to make the constituents happy and to listen to this very important board and your suggestions.
Thank you, then, Charlie. I appreciate that you guys will go clean this up for us and come back.
Not all of it.
We'll hang your fruit out, because I'll be a happy constituent because I won't have to spend more time doing it. So, you know, I think that, you know, the idea, you know, of where we're going as opposed to where we are is a very important concept. You know, you've all seen the development plans for downtown Derby. Although we've seen many different iterations of many different plans over many years, and COVID throws its own set of strange things there. You know, in conversations with, you know, state, you know, officials who see Derby as a viable next growth spot, you know, the quote unquote affordable bedroom community for New Haven or whatever, when you pass Orange and all these other places, then the question of, you know, what are we going to be, is in some ways captured in this. The reason I was looking at the stops is because when you started citing these different communities, Vin, that have different, that have similar characteristics in terms of their styles. The Alvin Penn legislation in 2016 was put in place because many of these same communities were found to be the percentage of stops of African American and Latino drivers was extremely, it's far above that of the norm. I was looking to see where Derby was on that, but it was not one of the listed because it's not immediately adjacent to one of the cities that was either the four cities that was, you know, Waterbury, New Haven, Bridgeport, and Hartford were the four cities that were the key statistical harbingers for that. And we are, I don't think, direct, except for in some small, no, we're not in any direct connect with any of those cities. Interestingly enough, Shelton was actually one of the lowest of those cities that was in direct connect in terms of that type of questionable or statistic regarding police stopping of Black and Brown people. So just, you know, for the statistical record, you know, on that ground, despite whatever's going on in Shelton right now, you know, a person of color might feel safer to drive in Derby, I mean, than in Shelton, than in many different cities.
And just chime in for 1 second. They don't stop cars, anybody. They don't stop minorities. They don't stop anyone. If you looked at the stop statistics, mm-hmm. I think the 2 years ago, they stopped 300 cars, where we were in the thousands. So it's just a cultural thing. And I mean that police culture wise, they don't do motor vehicle stops.
Okay. Back to Shelton. Actually, I got stopped in Shelton, by the way, just to let you know. I used to coach soccer at the Knoxville Valley Boys and Girls Club, indoor soccer. And one night coming home, I did get stopped because my the taillight to my tag was out. So that horrendous offense was cited, and I fixed it. Let's see. I had a couple other. So this idea of property rights becomes a dividing line between what goes on with the union and those. And I'm using the term beneath only in terms of a structural statement. In those officers that are beneath that line, and then above that line with the two leaders that report to the chief, whatever they are called in any document. And they are outside of that collective bargaining agreement, which brings into question the collective bargaining agreement itself. So out of ignorance, although in all the things that have been happening around the state and around the country, those collective bargaining agreements have become the subject of a whole lot of conversation, because that is wherein the things that happen to police when they are found to be astray of optimal performance is played out and is governed by the collective bargaining agreement. Hence, you know, our committee's decision to talk about these two top positions, or these three top positions, separately than we do the positions that are beneath them on the chart. And I'm very, very concerned. I mean, Vin, what you said was that those property rights, you know, play out differently in the public sector than they do in the private sector. The idea that then, what's the time period we have to hold it steady the same way? I mean, at what point does someone say, well, you know, when I joined the police force 32 years ago and took the test and became a policeman, I was expecting that I was going to one day rise to the rank of lieutenant or deputy chief. And my goal was always to become the chief of police. And so because I spent my first 12 years or 10 years or 5 years or 13 years or 20 years, you know, serving with the expectation that once I got there, that was going to be my next step, then you've injured my rights based on that same theory. You know, where is that line drawn? You're still on mute, Vin. You're on mute.
The line is drawn at the contract level. So, the example I'll give is if a community offers a pension, and then they decide they're going to change from a pension to a, I believe it's a 401B in the public sector. You can change from a pension to a 401B, but it's for new hirees going forward. You cannot affect that pension interest of those who are subject to contractual relations already. So the short answer is the line is at the contract level. Anyone who has a right pursuant to contract, it's gonna be a protectable right. So you can change it. I think the suggestion or the word grandfather in, you know, if you make a change and it's for people who are not yet hired, that is the way to make the change, because you're not then infringing on anyone's rights.
So I think that in lieu of saying, well, because this is the way that it is, and many people who might ascend to that place 20 years from now would have the desire to do that, but we will then, you know, if we don't make a change now, what we're saying is that we will never make a change. This the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single footstep. And so do you see some adverse reaction to that type of change that would protect us in theory against that property rights argument?
Unless the chief takes an early retirement, we're talking about something that maybe 20 years into the future. So if that soon, you know, because if there's someone in line for succession already, and this chief is in place for another decade and a half, that person I don't know ages, Chief, but that person could be around for 20 years after that.
Well, the thing is that,
yeah,
I mean, you're pretty much locked in for the next at least decade between the two of us.
And so I would quote, at risk of trying to, you know, biblicize the statement that a wise person leaves an inheritance for their children's children. And so I'd be in favor of moving that with the understanding, and that's, you know, not trying to redress or test Ben's legal argument there. That,
just to throw something at you, it's actually an interesting legal concept. Let's assume we were to make the change right now, right? And let's assume that there's three people in the ranks that are eligible for the succession, but we've just robbed them of that. We just changed the rules right now. If this chief is going to be around for 10 years, 15 years, just because we've changed the rules doesn't mean one of those three are not going to become the chief, right? So their claim today, I would argue, is not right, meaning it's not reviewable, because we don't know yet whether or not they've suffered damages. They, you know, because they're still going to be eligible to apply for the position. Only one of them is going to get it, no matter which way the rules are written. And if one of them does ultimately get it, then no one can claim that they've been damaged. So it's an interesting legal argument. So even if you were to make those changes today, the colorability of a claim that is brought against the city may not stand in court today.
And you know, I mean, I'm sitting here as someone who does not personally know any Derby police officer. Although once my alarm went off and several officers showed up very expeditiously to my house, which was a comfort to my wife and I, and circled, just walked around the house, made sure everything was okay. That was a great comfort to know I live in a town or city where the police actually do show up when the alarms go off. Thank you, Jared. But the idea that I don't know anyone has nothing to do with anyone I know or what I expect them to do or don't expect them to do. Is the way I look at Derby and hope what Derby will become as it continues to grow. Because unless COVID has a terrible set of twins that are following it and many other things happen, then Derby's going to grow. And when Derby grows, it's going to become more diverse. Our world is becoming more diverse, period. No one can stop that. It is happening in our midst. And in leaving an inheritance for our children's children, I think we need to understand, even with the statement that, you know, someone that knows Derby, you know, I didn't know Derby particularly 10 years ago. I knew of Derby because I lived in Shelton. I knew it was over there, but I didn't have anything to match or compare it with. So, you know, notwithstanding, you know, Vin's statement, which if you'd made it a half hour ago, Vin, I would have just jumped in there and said, let's go for it right now.
Proceed with caution.
but realistically, I think that it would be, you know, my idea would be that we address it with the idea that, you know, when we get to that place, and I think it's going to be a clear, if the charter is going to be voted, then there's going to have to be a clear delineation or understanding for people that are voting on it, you know, what the implications of it are, both now and future. And I think that's where a good, sharp legal opinion on that for voters would be helpful, so that people can understand what we think as a committee and what the alders think we as a committee are looking at. We're not looking, you know, to, I'm sorry, I have to replug. Give me 3 seconds here. Lest I disappear into the night suddenly. We're not, you know, this isn't an attack upon the police. It's a realization that leadership should in some way reflect qualified constituency. And qualified constituency 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, is certainly going to be different than it is now. So, you know, that's my thought on it for people's consideration. And let's see. One other thought is that when you change from when you tilt from written to oral, I understand the idea that that part of policing, part of law enforcement, is being able to interpret and respond to situations and people. But I also understand that there is a higher level of subjectivity that comes when those oral interviews occur. And therefore, it creates a greater space for a potential reliance on things that people are comfortable with, or people that you're comfortable with, or expressions that you're comfortable with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not, sounds like that's something that's already been done. Is that something that's already been done, Jerry? And two, if it has been, then I would really highly suggest a relook at that because of the potential piece there. For example, in Bridgeport where I work, part of the challenge with the police and fire tests were is that some of the subjectivity that comes with the oral response segment was really being questioned. I think that the background of views and that kind of stuff sort of speak for themselves. And although there's not always a level of comfort there because of the propensity of African American people to be arrested more often per capita than other populations, to be charged per capita more often than other populations, then, those things in themselves can be dangerous unless there's someone that's in charge of that recruiting process that really does direct it towards meaningful in occurrences. And then the last thing there is that I don't know about credit as a scoring item as well. So just in reviewing those scoring items that you mentioned, Jerry, I'm absolutely concerned about the oral, and I think that we have to take a real hard look at the written, because those things that are skewed against a certain population, which they are because of the statistical number of African Americans and Latino Hispanics that interface with police and end up with some sort of mar on their record, would lead us to absolutely tighten the pool more than you would in the Anglo population.
To several of your points, my night job outside of the day job is I'm a college professor at the University of New Haven in the forensic science department. So I get a mix of criminal justice and forensic science students, both graduate and undergraduate level. And I informally poll them and try to recruit and push policing on them. Over the last 3 or 4 years, absolutely zero. Nobody wants to be a police officer anymore. And that's across the board. And that's not race or sex specific. So that's pretty difficult. The other thing is that we don't do anything in-house. I can tell you some horror stories on a promotional exam before I was a police officer here, where they hired a high school English teacher to come up with a 10-question essay test. And one of the questions, and you can't make this stuff up, was, I forget which president was in the office, how do you feel about his a position with homosexuals in the military? How could you possibly answer that? That is not an objective question. It's absolutely subjective. So the written test questions that are created are done by a professional organization that does nothing but create these test questions. And I think actually ours is in either Virginia or North Carolina, and they use a variety of companies. So I don't buy a test. We are a member of South Central Criminal Justice Association. They are the region that we are members of, and they run our testing process for us. So they vet the tests from the vendor. There's a PhD that actually does that for us who runs the South Central. They have the ability to challenge questions. There are specific right answers, and they can point to the testing material for promotional exams, et cetera. They also do our hiring exams as well. As far as the oral board, I will tell you, I think it's a phenomenal process. If you haven't sat through one, it's a panel of three or five professionals in the industry. So it's at the rank of or the rank higher than you are testing for or being promoted into. So you will have patrolmen, FTO, or sergeants sitting on an entry-level oral board. There'll be a series of 10 questions. Those 10 questions were selected. They were offered up by the person that runs the program so that they are objective questions. They're not made up by the panelists. The panelists choose from the pool of them and agree on them, and there's a mix of them dealing with, you know, knowledge of the law to basic constitutional rights to common sense. And then what happens is each person will score them based on, number one, I'm doing this from memory, command presence, technical correctness, and rationale behind them. And you get a chance to look at the insight of the person. So let's say different day and age, because the world is upside down right now, but put it back 20 years when I was involved in this more intimately, you'd have a concern about somebody being at a parade and burning a flag in a crowd of people. So the concerns that you would talk out would be having to do with something like, okay, well, it's an American flag. There is no crime about that, but you are lighting a fire next to people. So that may be a problem with, you know, endangering them. Now we have a First Amendment right. So these are the things that people should be going through in their head. And the last thing we want to see is arrest them or don't arrest them, or, you know, you can't burn a flag. Just lack of knowledge. So once they answer, each person is scored in those different arenas. You come up with a total of 25 points per question. And then what happens is the three panelists will norm the questions with the proctor being there. And they'll discuss the answer and come up with an amicable answer that it's usually pretty much on. If somebody scores an 8, 8 and a 7, they'll talk it out. But you never see something like a 3 and a 10. That's never happened on any panel that I've been on. But to get to your point, the oral board process has been in existence well before me. So I would say 40 so years. It's been controlled. There's never been complaints about the process. There's never been any lawsuits or discrimination complaints about it. And I've seen it work. And like I said, we're hands off. We get a list when it comes back to us. So this is done through other agencies and through a professional organization and proctor. And it's in the contract. So basically, regardless of the charter, the contract actually goes in specifically how the promotion happens, you know, when there's a vacancy, the time frame, when it occurs. The charter refers to the state police being a proctor. They're not. We talk about civil service. We don't use civil service. So there's a bunch of language that can be cleaned up in here, but a lot of that is codified into a CBA, and that CBA is in its, I think we've got 4 more years left on it. We're entering, you know, year three of a 6-year contract. So
two quick questions. So the panelists, where are the panelists from, these three panelists?
So here's an example. If we're talking entry level, normally what will happen is South Central Criminal Justice will run examinations for entry level. For example, I want to say we have like 14 or 18 communities, and you might have five or six of those being run. What we'll generally do is we'll send a field training officer or somebody from different organizations. Sometimes we will send a panelist to a panel that we're involved in, and sometimes we'll send one just because we're part of this region, and they can be from anywhere. Now, we don't know who they're applying to, because you'll have four or five agencies, you know, applying, and you'll have three or four locations. So it's the pick of the draw on where you end up. On a promotional exam, like I said, if we were testing for the deputy chief position, your board may look like chief of police from Torrington. You may have, you know, a deputy chief from Ledyard, and you may have a chief of police from Westport. Somebody that's far enough away who wouldn't really know someone who was a candidate below the executive level chief or deputy chief. So they and there's actually they actually ask you to disclose if you know the person, if there's a conflict, and then they'll remove the panelists and they'll have somebody else sitting on the panel.
At what promotion level does a board convening occur?
Every level. So at every promotion. So just to be clear, in some organizations, so I'll give you an example. The state police, you become a trooper, that's entry level. To become a detective, it's an appointment. There is no there's no test, there's no rate and pay increase, there's nothing. To become a sergeant, you test. To become a lieutenant, you test. And I believe to become a captain. Everything above that grade is basically a political appointment. So all your high-ranking officers are simply political appointments, and they either sit in that position because of their knowledge or because of their relationships with other people or their job performance, but there's no physical exam or test. So some policing organizations have detectives that don't test, but in our organization, every position is testable. So you'll have an oral board at entry level and every promotion on up, with the exception of chief of police, because the testing for chief of police in Derby is done at the deputy chief level. And as long as you have met the minimum requirements, that's the direct succession. That's the whole principle of this. And to be honest with you, we're kind of leaving out an important part here with transparency. I answer to a police commission, and that's, you know, you can choose to have one or choose not to have one. The city of Derby chooses to have a police commission. I've heard the discussions on expansion of the police commission, which sounds like a great idea. I think you have to do it in odd numbers. It's got to be a 3, a 5, or 7, or 9, et cetera. The problem is that, as you've seen, and Charlie can vouch for this, nobody wants to run for political office. I think that's the problem we have. So asking more people to run on a ticket, you may have a small pool, and then even finding people that want to be commissioners. I found the best commissioners that work really well are business managers, people that understand business, because the police commission, what they do is they're public oversight over me. I answer directly to them. So that's kind of where the transparency comes. They hire, they fire, and they discipline. That's their primary responsibility. At one point in time, you know, there was a lot of policy, but a lot of the policy comes from industry standards and is not certification, but accreditation, et cetera. So there's no way the average person can write a policy, for example, on pursuit. That's statutorily mandated. So we're forgetting about the police commission, and I do answer to them. Now, the nice thing is, and I know it's difficult, but being a charter chief compels me to do the right thing. I won't be steered. I'll be honest with you, in the time I've been here between deputy and chief, I have never made a decision that I have regretted. I could have done some things a little different, but I'm always going to do the right thing. Because I have to answer to the people, and that's my job. I mean, it's about transparency. You know, the organization that I joined does not exist here anymore. It's different, and it's lonely at the top. I'm nobody's buddy here. I fight with the union all the time, and unfortunately, I have to because I'm going to do the right thing. And my deputy is the same, and my third in command. You know, he's an attorney as well. These guys put in their blood and sweat, and I do agree with you. An entry-level patrolman coming in can't expect to be chief and say, well, if you change the charter, you know, I've got some type of interest and I'm going to sue you. But people sitting in the seat or very close worked for it. So there, I think there is some fine line there, at least for the deputy that's currently there. And at least for, you know, me, if you remove me from the charter, then I rest with the police commissioners. And that's not the employment contract basically I signed up for. So that's goes back to the whole property right thing. I'm kind of rambling right now. So did I answer your question?
Let me just, so to be clear then, every promotion level has a board convening that is of the sort that you mentioned, drawn from around. So that's consistent, right?
That's correct. And the promotions are done by the police commission. So even though the results come in, basically the police commission is the one who does the promotion. I don't promote.
Mm-hmm. So then the idea of the police commission, I have a sort of a question that is not in this last line, but it goes straight to it. And so I'll ask it now and then come back to it. Civilian review boards and your feeling about that. But in terms of the police commission, the idea that the police, so help elevate my knowledge and understanding. So right now our police commission is appointed?
Correct.
Okay. And so we've had this sort of this conversation within the larger charter review board about people wanting to run or trying to get people to run as opposed to appointed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the idea that I'm not even sure in this moment, because my mind is on those review boards, is the idea of whether we are, you know, in our conversation as a charter review committee, I remember several lines of conversation, but I'm not looking at my notes, about the police commission and the police commission, you know, now being clarified that it's being appointed, and the conversation is whether or not that should be elected, and then a debate back and forth regarding election versus appointment. Do you have, I mean, professionally, and I say that honestly because I do think that I perceive you to be as a consummate professional as a law enforcement officer. I know a lot of law enforcement officers. I know the chiefs of all the big cities. And I know, you know, New Dora, no Jim, you know, at that level. Your opinion about appointed versus elected police commissions?
I really don't have any deep thoughts on it. I think it's an issue with finding people who would want to run. You have positions you have trouble filling today on the Board of Aldermen, on the boat, on ZBA, and all these, not ZBA, but any of these elected positions are going to be difficult. And when you add more of those to the slate, I don't know how that's going to play out. I really don't have a preference for one or the other. What I found to be the most effective is someone who's got a business savvy and deals with unions. Because that's a lot of the stuff that comes up. You have to remember that the police commission is a discipline board as well. So what ends up coming into there is you'll have ridiculous requests come in. You'll have labor actions that will come in that they have to answer, grievances. And if somebody doesn't understand the union environment, it could be problematic. You know, we try to figure this stuff out on the lowest level, but then there's stuff where we just reach impasse on. You know, one of the most recent things we have is we have a municipal prohibitive practice filed against the city because the police officers didn't want to have their temperatures taken, you know, in the COVID era. And there was some background behind that. And that's the kind of fight we have to fight, and the commissioners need to understand that. So I don't think there's any difference between the elected versus the appointed. It's, you know, I saw that people were looking for a diversity and minority representation. I don't think you can elect that. I think that's actually easier to appoint, but I don't know the solution to that. I think Vin would have to chime in on that.
So, of course, that minority, as was pointed out to me by Mark when we discussed that, is political minority and not, you know, cultural.
That's correct. No, I'm saying the political minority is something that's referred to with the police commission, but the diversity of the board as far as, you know, composition, I mean, it's easier to appoint, to be blunt, than it is to elect. I mean, the people would have to elect whoever they wanted. I don't think you can force diversity into an election. I mean, that's...
Yeah. So,
and you can't force diversity into appointments.
Correct.
You know.
So, you know, well, of course, appointment becomes the mind of the person that's doing it, whether they choose correct. Diversity or not. Listen, I know we've been, we're pressing that 2 hour. Well, no, we're not. We started at 6:30. So still working some more. And again, this is just an opinion, Jerry. So for the civilian review boards, that hasn't been something that it's not a charterized discussion issue. But since we're all here, I thought I'd ask you for you know, your elevator speech on that one.
Yeah, I really don't know enough about it. I think civilian oversight is a great thing, and I'm actually kind of ignorant on the composition of a review board. To be honest with you, if and I'm not trying to dodge the question, nobody's really asked me my opinion on this stuff. The problem we have is very strong unions, and if you think it's tough to get rid of a police chief, try getting rid of a unionized cop. Then we have things in the collective bargaining agreements that reset clocks. So I'll give you an example. At one point in time, this is what I fight tooth and nail to change. At one point in time, an officer can do something, they get a verbal warning, then that's removed from their file. 6 months later, they do something again, they get a verbal warning, that's removed from their file. And then all of a sudden you end up with a bunch of this stuff, and 10 years later, something serious occurs, a use of force, et cetera, and the person has no discipline in their file, even though they've been disciplined. So I don't know how you're going to butt heads with the unions and how fast or effective that can be, but think of the analogy of an attorney. If an attorney steals your money and embezzles your money, you can have them arrested. But you also have a licensing agency. You have a bar that you can make a complaint to. In Connecticut, we have a weak complaint process and decertification process with POST, our certifying agency. And I think that's where you need to go after this type of stuff, where you can start suspending people's police licenses and working with that. So I think legislatively, that's a strong direction that we have to go in. And basically, we're running an internal affairs investigation. We can be running a criminal investigation against somebody, and now you have a licensure investigation against somebody. Civilian Review Board, I have to be honest with you, I'd have to see how that animal looks and what powers it would have and the checks and balances, because everything having to do with employment and public service has to do with due process and how things are done and people's rights. We also have some other stuff. We have some weird beasts in law enforcement. We have Weingarten. We have a whole bunch of different types of procedures that we have to deal with as well with unions. So I don't know how that looks, and I really don't know. Do we have them in Connecticut? I'm actually kind of ignorant about that as far as civilian review boards.
So they do exist with different levels. It's sort of a design build process for each community. And have happened to have been involved in a couple of conversations and for Hartford, for example, and their review board, and now they're retooling it, usually in larger cities because of the diversity of actions that police get involved in, you know, and so that would be up to the municipality to do that. And that's part that part of that becomes fodder for the negotiation, the contract negotiation with the union, and as people press harder or less hard for it based on how the union feels about it, which is generally absolutely negative. Not many unions want a civilian review board as a part of a process. That's just gives another level of oversight, another place for what they might consider to be infringement upon their contract rights. But that leads me to the question, where are we at with the police contract now? What year of how many years are we in, and when's it up for reviewing?
I want to say I have it up here somewhere. Hold on 1 second.
Having been engaged in this conversation both nationally, regionally, statewide, and locally in some municipalities, the conversation about those police contracts really become the place where when there's real harm to civilians at the hands of a police officer, that really is probably the most central, in my mind, the most central document, because it covers many of the things you just mentioned, Jerry, about how things are recorded over time, and also the levels of discipline that police officers can receive for a varying number of different offenses. And so I think that, because that happens with a contract, then certainly I think that, probably a real analysis of, what's happened over the years. I appreciate, you said something about, no complaints about the promotion process. And I don't mean to be diminutive in any way when I say this. But we have to understand the reality of where we are. And it's not the reality of where we are, it's the reality of where we have been and the question of where we're going. If you've ever seen the movie Just Mercy, and if I ask you if you haven't seen it, to please take a look at it, because it's a real case from just, 20 or 30 years ago that occurred, in the United States of America, and that occurs around. No complaints doesn't mean that there are not any complaints. No complaints means that there might mean, carefully stated, that there is no place for a complaint, and the cost of the complaint is much more high than accepting whatever it is that you have received. That would be the cost for a complaint. And as a matter of fact, as a young man I've lived in seven different states and two different countries. And in the United States, from Georgia to California to Colorado to New York to Connecticut to Virginia, where else? Might be a couple other places along the way. But the idea of that each one of those communities has its own colloquial relationship with police. And there are places where you just don't complain, because if you complain, the price of complaining is much more weighty than the beating you got or the disrespect that you got or whatever else has happened. And I think that if we understand what's happening in our country now, then we understand that there is a group of young people who have grown up with a different culture than the one that almost anyone except for Chris looks sort of young over there, younger than me. I can't claim anyone younger than me except for Chris or Vin, maybe. Mark, I can't remember what you look like. But the whole idea is that they grew up differently, and they grew up with a different level of interface, culturally, racially, geographically, exposure-wise with all the media that's out there. I want to be careful that we don't see no complaints as no problems. We're looking forward to say, how do we review the process and make sure that it's as clean as possible? I have been treated well by the police in Derby. I've been, in one case, stopped when I was wrong and made a mistake. and treated kindly by the officers that stopped me. I was glad I was in Derby and not in Ansonia. I was right crossing the line when that happened. And then, you know, in other cases, as I said, police coming in and to the house when the alarm's gone off, stuff like that. Always been greeted, if not cordially, certainly respectfully, as we've passed each other in different places. And again, I don't know any police officer personally. I sort of know what guys look like because I drive down 34 every day. And so that group that sits out there and does the traffic, we wave at each other. Hey, you know, I wear a suit and a tie every day. So I just want to make sure that as we go forward, and I want to caution against the idea that no complaints doesn't mean no problems. It might mean what is meant for years and years for generations of people like me, which is to complain is a bigger problem than the problem you had that you were going to complain about. And that's a reality, whether people like it or whether it agrees with people's craw or anything like that, you know, that's the experience. And people like me, you know, love places like Derby and are going to move to places like Derby over the course of the next 10 or 15 years. Last statement, you know, I'll stop talking this diatribe. And that is that also the cultural diversity that is occurring means that, you know, if you just go to the mall next time it actually gets open and watch the kids walking by, and you'll see that 60 to 75% of the couples of young kids are diverse couples, whether they be internationally diverse or ethnically diverse. And those are the people that are going to be living in our neighborhoods. And so we're setting the framework. That's why I said, let's look at that. Okay, what does it mean to change it now? It means something 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and 20 years from now, when there'll be a different set of people populating these streets. It is not hard to predict at all. It's an inevitable reality. So thanks for listening to that impromptu, hadn't planned to say it speech. But I think that it should govern how we look at the charter. I mean, how can we not look at the charter? What we've experienced in the charter is a charter that has been stuck in time with all these little pieces that nobody has moved. And I think that we have the blessing, the obligation and responsibility to look forward. I look forward to getting to know you, Jerry, especially since you're going to be around for a while. If the Lord allows me to live too, then I think the first time we met was when we stood together at the peace rally over at downtown. It's the first time we've met. But like I said, I know that the chiefs at other places because of the work I do around the state. So I don't have anything else, but I'll certainly leave it open for any other comments. And then Jerry and Vin, whatever you want to say to close us out.
Well, just a real quick follow-up on your last statement. I think it's a perfect opportunity to discuss this. I have a forum that's going to be coming up that I'm actually kind of creating. It's going to be police, fire, EMS, local government, dealing with diversity, basically a listening session. And we want to hear this type of stuff. And most importantly, the Board of Education, because I've received a lot of complaints and I'm really listening and seeing a lot of things that are occurring, you know, the pipeline to prison, all this type of stuff. And I think that's the venue and the forum to discuss this. So I'll send you an invite to that, but don't want to drag that into the charter revision part. I understand how you're linking it in, but we're going to continue the conversation. Just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you, Jerry. Chris, Charlie, you guys got anything? Aniela?
Yeah, no, I mean, first things first, thank you very much, Mr. Narowski, for coming and talking to us. I know that we would have loved to have done this at a different time, certainly. I have had no issues whatsoever with Derby Police. I've had great interactions with them, but like, I know I grew up in Beacon Falls. Like, we used to go smoke pot in the woods and nobody ever bothered us. And we were, you know, we're always able to do that. I think that, you know, one of the things that I've learned through this conversation is certainly like at the police commissioner level, or even at the level of just, of politics, that's how we're going to change. One of the things that I like to see and have seen, and I don't think that a charter can be effective at, is, you know, that balance of over policing and under policing, and also of, you know, that the broken windows theory of policing versus the community policing, you know, and that sort of thing. That's just going to be, the more I've listened to this whole thing, I don't know that our charter can deal with it outside of maybe expanding the police commission. But that, of course, has its own set of risks in terms of, like, well, these are the folks making those decisions, and they have to have the level of skill set, and they have to have the understanding of unions and, you know, deal in the murk. So someone who has an idea that they want to see community policing and the balance of under policing, over policing, you know, we want to give those folks the opportunity to do so. But we also, you know, want to make sure that our police commission can certainly continue to do the work and do it effectively. So, you know, that's, I guess it's just a political thing, you know, more so than something our charter is going to be able to deal with. But I mean, everything Mr. McCluster said was, I mean, it's certainly spot on, you know? And I said, like I said, I thank my lucky stars every single day that I grew up where I did, and it was very rural, and that the things, the issues that affect other folks, especially in the past and hopefully never into the future, I didn't have to do. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. That was my takeaway from it. So thank you very much.
If I can, real quick, first of all, thank everybody for coming. I have to be honest, it's kind of refreshing. I mean, being involved in the political spectrum now that I like how I am, it's, I like how we can come to the table and have this kind of discussion, and everybody comes prepared, everybody's informed, and we're just, we all have the same goal, and which is to do what we can for the city of Derby. Listen, I've been here for, you know, me and my family have been here for generations and decades. So whatever we can do to help, I think we should do. I think we should, like Carl said, we should do justice to the people. If we have to keep a conversation going, maybe not this week, maybe not next week, but in the future, to at least sit down, because we owe it to the people to, you know, if there's stuff we can do, to do it. If we're all on the same page, great. But I have to be honest, it's, you know, there was a lot of information tonight, all very good stuff, and I'm just real happy the way this is kind of turning out. So that's all.
Charles, you got anything?
No, I just, you know, thank you for your hard work, and you know, everything you're saying here is valid and should be looked at. And I'm also, Chief Nowrowski, if I could get an invitation to your little meeting. Mr. McCluster, another thing you don't know about me, I'm also a union vice president, so I kind of tend to keep quiet when you talk about contracts, but I agree with the chief, you know, that reforms have to be made, and some of it has to come through the contract. But once again, thank you guys for your time.
So my last thing, thank you, Charlie, and if Mark is still there, he'll share whatever he wants. I just hope that, you know, there's prudence and, you know, a real understanding. I mean, you know, I'm a believer in collective bargaining, and I think it's a principle upon which we've stopped, you know, a type of industrial slavery in this country that hurt generations and generations and generations. You just go to the to Pennsylvania, to the mountains and the coal mines, and see people that work 6.5 days a week, and they got a half hour off, a half a day off on Sunday morning, so they could go to church, have dinner with their family, and then go back to the afternoon shift. And then they lived in the housing that was provided by the Vanderbilts and the nothing personal, but, you know, the Mellons, and these are the people that owned everything. And they bought at the company store. And when the husband died, then you had 30 days to get out of the property because you were renting company housing. You know, unions were part of the breaking that chain of a type of certain industrial slavery within our country. And at the same time, you know, while we all defend our rights, I think it's really important that as a part of this, that the union be realistic about the rights of citizens too. You know, one of the things, I was in a meeting with the four quote unquote big city chiefs and the commissioner, because of all the things that are going on. I had some of the young activists that were in there and some pastors and stuff, probably about, you know, 16, 18 people about 4 weeks ago. And one of the challenges that that the chiefs and the commissioner said and talked about was, it's just the challenge of when, you know, an officer does not perform or does things that are wrong, and that sort of blank slate that can be given because of the strong advocacy of the union. I've always said I agree with the union, but I want to argue for prudence and sensibility as we go forward, fairness and equity, you know, for the people that are, you know, last statement, I promise, that is that, you know, just because a priest or a pastor does something wrong doesn't mean that every priest or pastor is wrong. Just because a bus driver runs off the road doesn't mean that every bus is going to be dangerous. Just because every law enforcement law enforcement officers, you know, are abusing the privilege that they have to protect and serve, does not at all mean that all cops are bad. But what makes it feel that way is when those cops that do those things are protected by the agreements that are negotiated between the unions and the cities that sign off on them. And so I pray that as we look at the contracts going down, going forward, that those safeguards for citizens will be in place, because it's just right, you know? You know, it's just right. You can sue a doctor who leaves a sponge in you. What happens when you get mistreated by a police officer? It's not every officer at all. I haven't met one in Derby that I feel uncomfortable with. But, you know, that's where we stand today. So, Jerry, again, thanks. I really appreciate your leadership. I appreciate your knowledge of the field, of the profession, and the way you carry it out. I saw that the night that we were together at the Green, and I hear it today in your voice. So thank you. You know, we didn't begin with the Pledge of Allegiance, but I'm going to suggest that we end with it, because I think it means something to all of us. As I drive down Lakeview, a lot of my neighbors there have like the tents with the flags on it and stuff like that. And so we got a wave party going on every time we go down, just experiencing the joy of being in a country that's not like any other one. And we just want to keep it that way. How about that? Hey, there you go, Chris. You're a beast, man. Is Mark there? Or is Mark gone? You there, Mark?
Oh, I'm here.
Anything before we close?
Nope. I think that you covered everything. And just for the other members, it looks like we're gonna have the meeting on Wednesday, not Tuesday. So.
Okay. Great.
Well, great to hear. Have listened to a great, productive and insightful conversation this evening.
So I'll put my hand over my heart as I say it. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Amen. Have a great night, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Have a good night. See you on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Wednesday it is.